Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest.
And if I say one word slightly out, they say he's cognitively impaired.
October 24th, 2024, the Disinhibited Fascist Edition. I'm David Plotz from CityCast in Washington, D.C. I'm really sweaty. I've had computer problems, but my back feels better for all those keeping track of my health and or hygiene issues. From CBS News in New York City, John Dickerson. Hello, John.
And if you haven't ordered your David complaints checkoff list, you can get that by emailing it's Slate.
That's what Slate Plus members get.
That's right. Exactly. That's exactly right. They get a hi, gang.
Also in the gang, Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine and Yale University Law School. She is the lawyer for the gang. Hello, Emily.
Hello, hello.
You would not go to prison. John and I would get sent to prison. You would represent us, even though you were in on all of our dirty deeds, but you used your attorney-client privilege to keep yourself sort of clean.
I don't know. If I knew about the commission of a crime or fraud as it was occurring, I could be in big trouble too.
I've noticed how careful you are to leave the room when John and I talk about the commission of a crime or fraud. This week on the Gabfest, the state of the presidential race 2 weeks to go, does early voting tell us anything? And the interesting discussion of whether Trump is a fascist and whether it matters. Then, are young men supporting Trump because society has abandoned them and invested too much in girls and women? We will talk to Rachel Simmons about why young men are feeling left out of American
progress. Bad zero-sum framing of that question, I object. Continue.
Okay, I did that to antagonize and provoke. I knew that when I was saying. Then, the University of Michigan has a massive DEI apparatus. We're going to talk to Nick Confessori of the New York Times about his investigation into how that university's efforts to promote diversity have gone awry. Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter. And a reminder, listeners, we have a live GabFest coming up in Brooklyn at the Bell House on Wednesday, December 4th, our annual conundrum show. You can get tickets at slate.com/GabFestLive. There's also a VIP meet and greet ahead of the show for those of you who want to get those tickets. We're going to have a special guest. We're just discussing who that's going to be. And we're going to conjure answers to amazing questions like, what is the best Thanksgiving side dish, bar none? Who is on the Mount Rushmore for non-political Americans? And things like that. The questions that are even more out there than that. So anyway, get your tickets at slate.com/GabFestLive. The Bell House, Wednesday, December 4th in Brooklyn. And if you have a conundrum, submit it at slate.com/conundrum. Please submit them. We need conundrums. Less than 2 weeks until Election Day, the race is tighter than whatever you want. My belt after Thanksgiving, a parking space in Manhattan, you pick it. Two alley cats in a tin box. Any metaphor you choose, it is very hard to think about the election, for me at least, without getting anxious and stressed out and a feeling of like, what is there to talk about? How can we do anything? What's going on? And I totally understand if you, dear listener, want to skip the next 12 minutes. But there's a lot going
David
on in the race.
David will skip it with you as he talks. He's not really here.
I'm elsewhere. I've moved elsewhere. The most interesting thing I read this week, y'all, actually, I thought was Ezra Klein's discussion of Trump's mental state in the Times, which focused not on his mental and cognitive decline, but more on the insight that Trump's primary trait is disinhibition. And that's what makes him different than most politicians and most people. He behaves in public the way we dream of behaving when we are our worst selves. What did you make, Emily, of this disinhibition argument by Ezra and also the rage that it induced in so many people?
Well, I think that he's right, but also it's not either or. And I was confused about why he decided to make it either or, because age increases traits like disinhibition. It makes people's grooves of personality deeper. And so it seemed like there was an additive happening here rather than a choice, but Ezra didn't frame it that way. And so he, along the way, kind of minimized the idea that, you know, there's some kind of mental deficiency related to age that is changing how Trump speaks and thinks. And it seems like there's pretty good evidence that, in fact, age is playing a role and that these two things are related and intertwined. It's not a choice. And I felt kind of mystified about why Ezra was minimizing the age part And I think the reason people were so mad is that Ezra is a person who I think for good reason gets credit for having called out Biden's mental acuity early on. And so for him to minimize that issue with Trump seemed odd.
I recall him saying exactly what you said, which is that it's gotten worse with age. I'm obviously susceptible to this argument because I made it in my book 4 years ago, that restraint, which he calls disinhibition, is the biggest challenge with Donald Trump. But we used to talk about it, remember when he used to talk about being presidential, and he said, I could be presidential, but that would be boring. What that was really a tell is he couldn't be presidential. And for me, that has always meant sublimating your personal impulses for the greater good, whether it's norms or the Constitution. And so I was inclined to, you know, believe his argument because I think it's the most important argument and has been since we've gotten to know Trump. So I could, maybe I misread it. I thought what he was saying is, sure, he's getting older, his impulses are getting worse, but the biggest thing happening in 2024 is something we talked about when we talked about the Project 2025 at the Heritage Foundation, which is that they are building a frame for him for the next presidency where all the guardrails that that restrained him because he has no inherent restraint. All those guardrails are being systematically, dismantled with real intention. You know, they're looking for people whose only quality is loyalty. Therefore, they won't erect any barriers to what Trump wants to do. And I would add another thing, which is Republicans have become practiced in the last many years of looking the other way or making excuses for Trump, that there is now like a thorough structure to accommodate this disinhibition, and that's what would be most dangerous in a second term. That to me, I think he was saying that's the bigger danger.
That's the way I read the piece too, as well as saying that whether or not the cognitive decline is occurring, I mean, I think the evidence is pretty strong, but that's actually not the most consequential piece of what is happening. And that's not the most consequential danger of Trump. And it actually led me to think about this other interesting contradiction, which I am not the person who pointed this out, but so much of the pro-Trump argument is saying, look, it wasn't so bad the first time around. All those bad things didn't happen. And that at the same time, they've set up the structure. The entire point of this next term is, you know, it's like Trump 2, the revenge. I mean, it's like all the stuff we had last time, we're not going to have this time, guys. So now we're going to get it. And so they want it both ways. They want it to be like, oh, it wasn't so bad. And also, oh, now we get to do what we really intend to do, which would have made it so bad. And that hypocrisy or that contradiction, I think, is something that voters really need to pay attention to.
Right. I mean, I spent my summer like mired in this stew in thinking about Trump's potential impact on the Justice Department. At the same time, if you are thinking about those voters who are saying, well, it wasn't so bad, it's all going to be fine, making them also think about the idea that age deepens the groove of disinhibition and could make Trump more like himself is also potentially useful and something that's easy for people to understand. Now, I mean, you know, Ezra's readership is not necessarily like the low information swing voters of the world. But to the extent that there's like some ripple effect there, I don't know. Look, I mean,
can you imagine there's some Ezra Klein voters like, I've never heard of this Trump guy. I'm so interested to learn about him.
Well, I know, but I mean, it just like there's a level of implausibility that anything any of us are saying has any impact on the people who are actually going to decide the election. So I note that. But, you know, to the extent that you're thinking about that argument, it was okay, why are you guys making such a big deal of the next time? Then I think that explains the frustration, I'm going to stick with my idea that I do think he was, relatively speaking, saying that age is not that big a deal with Donald Trump. And I think when you listen to Trump talk and you see some of what he's doing and how he's mixing up words and going on these like long tangents, like it is more. It's not like he never did that before, but it is more. And it probably is because he's older.
So we built a thing called the Panama Canal. We lost 35,000 people to the mosquito, you know, malaria.
Yeah.
We lost 35,000 people building. We lost 35,000 people because of the mosquito. vicious. They had to build under nets. It was one of the true great wonders of the world. As he said, one of the nine wonders of the world. No, it was one of the seven. It was, happened a little while ago, you know. Since nine wonders of the world. You could make nine wonders. He would have been better off if he stuck with the nine and just said, yeah, I think it's nine.
The problem is not the lack of mental acuity. The problem is the disinhibition.
But the problem could be both. It's not like a choice.
But age exaggerates the other, and the danger to the country is primarily the disinhibition, not the lack of mental acuity. As long as there are, you know, we see with Biden that Biden's presidency has not been significantly harmed by the fact that he's clearly lost a step cognitively.
But we all freaked out about the idea of having someone be president for four more years who seemed like he lacked mental acuity.
Well,
we did.
I think the freak out was he might lose.
He might lose.
Most of the country looks at him and says he's a
thousand. I personally was very troubled by the idea that he was going to be in office for 4 years. You know, that just did not seem like a good idea.
The problem has always been there is the argument. And of the two problems, what I think is true is that there's not the Trump's instincts are going to be encouraged in this way in which they weren't. Whether those instincts were with him since he was 1 year old, I love that quote repeated in Ezra's piece about from Trump saying, you know, I'm the same person I was when I was a 1 year old. Are they going to be worse? Sure, but what's going to be even different is, we know this is going to be different, is the structure around him will go away. Remember also one other just inconsistency with the way they argue that you guys have pointed out is that when J.D. Vance says, well, you know, the founders created a presidency that should have extraordinary powers, and the Supreme Court, of course, has said that too. The founders, all the way up to Jackson, wrote at length about the personal virtue required of the president because of all this amazing power. No one would accuse Donald Trump of having any of the virtues that the founders obsessed about when they created and thought about that office of the presidency.
He is a good golfer. They did think about that. The discussion of disinhibition connects to another theme of the week, which is the Mark Milley and John Kelly. John Kelly, former chief of staff, Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, right? Both called Trump a fascist, and both were raising kind of the alarm about what would happen if this fascist has a second term, disinhibited, not constrained by people like John Kelly and Mark Milley. All the things that prevented the worst from happening. When they call him a fascist, what does that mean?
Yeah, use state power for his own ends, I guess, is the way I think about it. But implicit in your question, David, is I find it confusing. I find all these jargon things confusing. I think if you're trying to make the case for why this is dangerous in a president, I think you don't. I mean, you can say the word fascist, but I think you pretty, and Kelly did. It was a long interview. But I think the idea that basically he's not inhibited by the Constitution or his oath or the norms, but will use the power, the extraordinary power he's given for his own impulses is what they mean. And I think the way, and this is a failure, I think, of the Harris campaign, is to connect that argument with people's real lives, which is there are a lot of these things that are going to concern you, Mr. and Mrs. Voter, and who's going to be thinking about you in office? Or who's going to be thinking about themselves and their, you know, strange behavior that we see on the stump. That connective tissue doesn't happen. And I think as a political matter, saying fascist possibly gets in the way of making that argument.
I really agree with you. Here, for the record, is the definition Kelly was using. A far-right, authoritarian, ultra-nationalist political ideology and movement characterized by a dictatorial leader, centralized autocracy, militarism, forcible suppression of opposition, belief in a natural social hierarchy.
But certainly, the former president is in the far-right area, certainly an authoritarian. Admires people who are dictators. He has said that. So he certainly falls into the general definition of fascist, for sure.
So, I mean, I agree with you, John. And actually, there's this, I thought, great article in my dear New York Times magazine by Elizabeth Zarofsky about a leading historian of fascism, Robert Paxton. And he was making the same argument as you, John, that it is relevant. Like, when you think about the history of fascism, he studied Vichy France. And one thing he says is distinctive is that it doesn't just come from the leader. It also bubbles up from underneath. There are people who are craving some kind of authoritarian direction. And he thinks that that is what's happening, but he also just doesn't think it's that useful, partly because it's obscuring differences that are true about every period of time. And also because it makes people tune out politically, I think. I mean, I kind of bridle at it, and maybe that's because I'm being too narrow and I just like think of Mussolini and Hitler and I can't quite make the connection, even though I should. But I think there's something about it that just seems like over the top. And it also seems to condemn anyone who supports Trump as like pro-fascist. And that seems super unhelpful.
I agree with both of you about the unhelpfulness of talking about it. I always go back to the piece. I really want to recommend everyone here go back and read the piece that Jonathan Rauch wrote in The Atlantic probably now 10 or 15 years ago about the number of people, Americans, who don't believe politics works. And he was so prescient about what happens when huge numbers of people in a political system stop believing that politics is effective, and they become very susceptible to the kind of authoritarian promises that Trump makes. And one of the things the Republican Party has done, one of the really specific and, I, to my mind, pernicious projects of the Republican Party, is to make people skeptical about politics and the effectiveness of government. Because the more you make them skeptical about the politics of politics and government, the more vulnerable they are to the kind of arguments that someone like Trump makes. And that bubbling up piece of it, I think, is not just that it's bubbled up, it's also been encourage that kind of thinking has been encouraged by right-wing leaders and right-wing media.
I do think it was notable that Kelly came forward to denounce Trump. It seemed like mostly because of Trump's statements about turning the military against Americans and this whole idea that Democrats are the enemy within. And I think that's important. And it's important to have people who worked for Trump to giving testimony that this is bad. And that's sort of why I wished he had stayed away from the fascist label, because then I just worry that people he might reach are going to tune him out.
I would add to those who are screaming and losing their minds right now, neither David or Emily are making a case that Trump is not or doesn't have fascist tendencies. I think they're both making an assessment of how useful it is at this very moment in a campaign, and particularly the use of that word to convey the true nature of Trump's challenge.
One final practical question, John, which I'm sure a lot of our listeners are interested in. So there have been significant numbers of Americans who voted early, and Republicans have voted early in greater numbers relative to 2020. How should our listeners think about that? Does it matter? Is it just that early voting means high proclivity voters are voting and they would have voted anyway, so it doesn't really make a difference? Or does it signal something, do you think?
I think it basically signals that. It's very possible that Republicans and Democrats, for that matter, are cannibalizing their day of vote, which is a weird way to talk about it, sort of an old-fashioned way to talk about it. But basically, they're voting early instead of voting on election day. I think what it does suggest with respect to Republicans, more of them are voting in person early or by absentee. And that suggests there's a disconnect between Trump's antics and the strategy of the campaign. And one of the big questions of this election is there a structure getting out the vote, getting Republicans to vote the way that's smartest, which is always to vote in person or by absentee, because then the campaign can focus on who hasn't actually voted in those last days. Does such a structure exist on the Republican side? And is it adult and professional when the candidate is not? And the fact that people are voting early on the Republican side suggests that could be the case.
The gender divide between young men and women in this presidential election is incredible. I think it's 51 points. Women are for Harris by 38. Young men are for Trump by 13. And this is a gender divide among the young that is much greater than it was in past generations. It's grown into a chasm only in this last decade, largely because women have moved left, men have more or less held steady. Young men have more or less held steady, moved a bit to the right. We invited Rachel Simmons to come talk to us about this because she will have really smart things to say. She's the author of Odd Girl Out, and she's the co-founder of Girls Leadership. And Rachel, you're here because you wrote a note to Emily. Summarize the note that you wrote to Emily about boys.
Sure. So hello, it's such a pleasure to be with you, longtime listener, Slate Plus member here. And I was frustrated. I'm feeling haunted by something that happened many times over the course of my years, pretty much at the center of the girls' empowerment movement in the early 2000s, which is that every time I would do a speech or, you know, be out and about working at a school, I would have someone come up to me and say, "What do you have for boys? Like, what are you offering for boys that is what you're doing for girls?" And I never had a good answer. And it's not that people weren't out there talking about masculinity. People were there, but there was no corollary movement. There was no mobilization of schools and parents and therapists. People were not paying attention to boys in the same way. And my worry is that a lot of those boys were left behind, and that they are the ones now old enough to vote. And they are the ones who are finding a home in the, frankly, kind of middle school masculinity that I think a lot of Trump rallies are offering them.
And what are the markers in the way that signal these boys have been left behind? Like, what are the evidence that we know that these boys are relatively left behind?
There's been tons of reporting lately on the economic troubles that are affecting non-college educated men. We know that they have suffered in pretty significant ways. And I would tie that, if I'm tying it back to my argument, I would say we gave girls opportunities to envision themselves as astronauts, as chemists, in every possible identity. We didn't go to boys and say, you can be a caregiver, you can be a teacher. And so many of the jobs that are actually more available tend to be traditionally female occupations, which boys don't feel comfortable necessarily, or I should say men, don't feel comfortable pursuing. And I think we also just see that woke culture has been, in some ways, I think men feel that that's been weaponized against them. And Emily, in your New York Times article earlier this month, you cited a Pew stat from June that I think showed that something like 40% of men ages 18 to 49, I'm just looking at my notes here, say, who support Trump, believe that women's gains have come at men's expense.
And that's higher than older men, just to keep proving your point. Yeah.
And compared with 17% of respondents overall. So I think that it's not just that women have gotten ahead and that we gave something to girls that I think, by the way, also powered Me Too. And it wasn't just that we were empowering girls. It was that we were authorizing them to have a set of arguments about male privilege and about their own potential. So it's not just, you know, I think it's kind of built cumulatively. And again, I think a lot of men feel left behind. And I guess what I was saying to Emily was my fear is that there's like an inner boy there that's been left behind, and that's who's pulling the lever at the ballot box.
I feel like there is a struggle to think about the educational falling behind challenges that men have as a group, because we just don't think of men as a minority group. Like, maybe we acknowledge that Black men have particular problems, maybe, but not men overall. When I was working on that piece, I interviewed the sociologist Arlie Hochschild, who does a lot of her work is all with in communities where there's a lot of support for Trump. And she said she was talking to a young guy, and he was like, men are the only minority group who nobody cares about, nobody has like a compassion for or interest in. And of course, we don't think of men as a minority group, right? And there's such a struggle around that. And yet, if you don't acknowledge that there are these challenges and you don't give people a way to feel good about their identity as you're emphasizing identity for everyone else, you're going to create a lot of like resentment. And there's something sort of cringy about being a young white guy right now that just cannot be helpful in terms of those people feeling like they're part of some larger social project.
I remember when we first started working in schools, and here's what we saw. We saw boys interrupting girls all the time, which I sort of reminds me of the little intro.
I don't think, I really don't. I don't think that's true at all. I can't, I mean, what do you,
Not to be too meta about it, but if I recall correctly, Emily was the interrupter. So she sort of disproved the point. But in the early 2000s, there was lots of reporting on kind of the withering on the vine of girls in schools. And they were being spoken over and they were not able to take up space. There was an epidemic of sexual harassment in the hallways, in middle schools particularly. And so in a lot of ways, it looked like boys were, quote unquote, doing just fine. But I think we mistook the power and the dominance that they were displaying for wellness. And they weren't okay, right? But we were able to sort of write it off that way. Because I think, obviously, as many of us know, masculinity is constructed to be about keeping your vulnerability shielded. So we didn't see it, and we mistook what we saw for something that it wasn't.
Because on the right, there's also been, both in the culture and in the academic work, I think about Nicholas Eberstadt, who at AEI has this interesting dual expertise. One is young men, and the other is North Korea. but he's been talking about this for a long time, and is one of the challenges, an economic one, which is that there, that as I recall, the basically men of working age and are not participating in work at the same level. In other words, unemployment can be low, but that doesn't count the fact that one in six men of working age are not even participating in the workforce. That there's no recognition of that. That, in other words, it's not just the feelings, but from a structural policy standpoint, nobody has addressed the fact that there's this portion of men who are just staying home and not engaged with the project of adult life.
I mean, to me, the most dangerous thing in the world is an unattached young man. Like, men without work, without labor, without meaning, without partners, without families are self-destructive. So they're vastly more likely to kill themselves and vastly more likely to harm themselves in some way. And they're also outwardly destructive. And we can wish that they were better and we can implore them to be better, but they're not. And they need dignified work and purpose and value to others. And women, and they need relationships with young women for the most part. But mostly with young women, not always. And they just, they're not getting it at the level and the amount that they need it. And that's, we can condemn them for being antisocial and destructive and having these poor values and doing bad things. But it, like, one thing that societies need to learn to do is to harness that destructive energy of young men and put it towards productive labor and productive relationships and civilization.
100%. And I think a lot about how school is not designed for boys. I think school is a place where compliance and self-regulation are king. And you can ask any middle schooler today, like, what's it like? What does it look like in a classroom? You know, who has it harder, the girls or the boys? My 12-year-old daughter told me last night, it's the boys, right? They call out, they interrupt. That hasn't changed, but we haven't adapted. You know, we haven't created pathways to the kind of economic stability and spiritual stability, I think, that you're describing, that we might see in things like vocational education. And I just saw some stat that college enrollment is now starting to drop. And I do wonder if in some ways that is evincing a loss of faith in institutions, particularly by men, because we know that men are not going to college already in equal numbers. But I think it's also, to your point, that they're not finding meaningful work or life given to them by that degree. And so the question I think remains is, what can we offer men? And I think it's a question for Democrats to consider following this election, because I really do believe that gender is like this mounting drumbeat that is going to be, I believe, the defining factor now.
I just want to bring Richard Reeves into this conversation because his work on this has been really important. And he's been writing about various specific ideas like health initiatives that are aimed at men and more support for a vocational education and community college, which could address some of the education gender gap you're talking about, Rachel. I appreciated the specificity of some of those ideas. And at the same time, I think to date, there has been some reluctance among Democrats to package those things in a way that makes it sound like they are for men, because there's going to be like side eye about the idea of treating men as a struggling group. And just there's just like a lack of recognition of the kind of falling behind. You're talking about, and then the real resentment that that leads to.
Yeah, I mean,
and it's not zero sum. It's not zero sum.
And that's
right?
what
it's
it comes
good
across
for women
as.
And
that's
everybody.
Right. That's right. I mean, I think that's what it's experienced as. And I think until we break free of this idea that for men to receive any kind of help, it's a deficit or a sign of some type of weakness, then we're just going to keep going in circles.
And then there's this weird, like, revenge, right? Like, all the jokes about, like, the eye rolling about men and their problems, as if, like, it's okay, fine. Like, let's stomp on them a little bit. It's time for them to, you know, be.
That's really
and
hard
it just,
for
like,
me.
Doesn't, it's not going to work.
It's so
just
problematic.
Doesn't work for too many of them.
Because it's also about which part of the elephant are you touching, right? Like, if you're looking at it from the level of how many women CEOs do we have, sure, you can roll your eyes at men being in trouble. But if you're looking at it from the perspective of people who are living from paycheck to paycheck, who are not finding meaningful work, you know, then you're just putting salt in the wound. So I do think it's a matter of perspective in many ways.
Maybe this is one narrow specific point, is that I'm kind of surprised that Kamala Harris is not going out of her way, pulling every possible string to get on the Joe Rogan podcast. I just don't understand. Like, you should at least be trying to talk to young men in an environment where young men are listening and are engaged. And, you know, Rogan, you know, I'm probably is more Trumpy than Harrisy, but he's a welcoming interviewer. And she could get a direct channel to some voters who might be gettable if she talked about the subjects, even if she doesn't get into too many particular policy specifics that she would regret. But I just don't understand.
I think that's such a good point. And I think instead she's going after the women. And that might be an oversight.
There is reporting that she tried to get on the show. So I mean, she may not have pulled every string. I don't know. I don't know what happened to it. But there was definitely several days of, you know, she's trying to get on the show. Maybe that was just signaling and it wasn't an earnest effort. I don't know. But I mean, I do think she tried. Is there something Kamala Harris could say on a Joe Rogan podcast that would hit this target? I don't know whether this is actually possible to do in one visit.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, that's what's haunting me, is that a lot of what is going to play out was put into place a long time ago and it's not going to be undone by a talking point. And to sort of tie back to what you were saying, John, about, you know, how can we provide new channels and new structures for men. I also want to say there's still an opening for there to be a movement on behalf of boys that works within existing institutions. Like, more teachers need to understand that, you know, boys struggle to sit still is not necessarily a discipline problem, but a developmental expression, developmentally appropriate behavior, for example, right? And so teachers pathologizing boys for acting out starts that process, that cascade of alienation and a loss of belonging. And if we did a better job helping teachers to rethink what educating boys looks like, we might not have to create these other institutions.
Rachel Simmons is the author of Odd Girl Out. Rachel, thanks so much for coming on the Gabfest.
Thank you.
Nick Confessori has a fascinating piece in the New York Times this week. The University of Michigan doubled down on DEI. What went wrong? It is a really, really, really deep and fascinating account of all that happened within the University of Michigan when it tried to set up, or when it succeeded in setting up, a huge DEI infrastructure in order to promote diversity, equity, and inclusion on the campus. And Nick, welcome to the Gabfest. Quickly give us a sense of the scale of DEI efforts at Michigan. How many people, how much spending, what's being done, and also why it came to exist.
Since 2016, the university has spent over $250 million on DEI in a program that has its roots in a series of protests by Black students in 2013 and 2014. And they have, by some measures, the largest DEI staff of any large public university in the country, which arguably means of any university in the country. And they have a deliberate effort in place to bring DEI to every single person on campus, to make sure it is involved in every program, in every department, every school, every business unit. And it was a really ambitious effort that was rooted in part in a longtime failure to raise the enrollment of Black students. That's where it began. It's not where it ended.
And just specifically, when you talk about having DEI involved in everything that happens on campus, can you give an example or two of how that might manifest?
So as you can imagine, this is a major state university. It is huge. The scale of the school is almost hard to comprehend. Tens of thousands of students, tens of thousands of faculty and staff. And every single unit, from the medical school down to the archives and the arboretum, was asked to come up with a DEI plan. The idea here was that if each school and college and library came up with its own plan, there would be buy-in from the ground up. It would be tailored to meet the needs of individual units, and there would be more success. As an example, at the nursing school, the most underrepresented group of people among the students is men. So they began an intensive effort to recruit more men. But at the main undergraduate program, the real emphasis, I think, was on equitable teaching, on a more diverse staff, and a more racially diverse student body, and in particular, to have more students from traditionally underrepresented groups.
So the University of Michigan has this particular challenge, which is that the state banned affirmative action, Black enrollment plummeted. It's an excellent school, but because it didn't have race-based affirmative action, it couldn't compete with like the Ivy League for talented Black students in quite the same way. And Black enrollment plummeted to the point of 4 or 5%, which means you just don't have critical mass on campus. One thing I was really struck by in your piece is that the Black students you were talking to were very dissatisfied with the university and did not feel like all this DEI was really helping them. And I wonder if you could talk about why that disconnect existed for them.
Well, I think there are two reasons. The first is, and this goes, I think, to the bigger quandary for DEI programs in higher education in general. It's one thing to have a DEI program that has as its main aim racial justice, which is to redress the past sins of the country, to redress the past terrible discrimination against Black people in particular, and you have other minorities, and to make that your focus. But when the voters of the state of Michigan said, no, you cannot use your most powerful tool for doing that, you cannot use racial preferences in admissions, they had to come up with all kinds of other things. And along the way, the arguments around diversity were changing, both in the courts and in the literature among psychologists and social scientists. And the argument became actually diversity of all kinds, so not just race, is good for everybody. It makes for better learning, better classrooms, better education. That was the argument made in some of these Supreme Court cases. And so it became less about redressing past iniquity against Black Americans. And I think you just see that in the spread and creep of these programs that take on so many different forms. That's one reason why they're unsatisfied. The second is, I think that some of the Black students feel it's simply not revolutionary enough, right? So in a way, it's not focused enough on them. It's not focused enough on reallocating power in society. It's not focused enough on a fundamental change in how the university operates. And that is a part of a long-standing critique at the among the left at Michigan, I would say, for decades, that it takes these demands for inclusion and corporatizes them and makes them something else.
So in any organization, you know, what all the books will tell you is the clear thing is you need sharp, clear goals that are usually like one or two words, if possible, to get everybody going in the same direction and to give purpose when people feel lost. Is it that? And some can look at this and say, well, like, it's just a bunch of fuzzy-headed academics, and they lack that skill, and so, of course, this was going to fail. But it sounds like what's happened is they could never say in a few words what they were trying to do, in part because there were legal challenges. So it was always something they had to kind of shilly-shally around, which means when you try to operationalize it, you lose focus.
I think that's a great description, probably more concise than what I said. Like, for example, when they began the first phase of this program, which is called DEI 1.0, they came up with 2,000 action items. Now, on the one hand, and some of those were centrally planned university-wide programs, and some of them were in the individual units. And so on the one hand, it sounds impressive. Wow, they're going to really transform the place. They're going to do so much. And what I found in talking to deans and former deans who were in charge of operationalizing some of these programs was that really it was a box-checking exercise. They had to show they were doing something. They had to come up with something. They did posters. They did a panel or a committee, or they hired a DEI person, or they didn't hire a DEI person. They had to put on paper a plan. And I think it's fair to say that obviously you have to do some of that to do something. I mean, you have to have a plan. But in a way, I think the ambition and sprawl of this plan has in part been its undoing. And I'm going to explain why. I think that the challenge is everybody kind of understands that racial equity is one of the underlying goals. But in a state, and of course now in a country, where you can't use the most powerful tool, racial preferences, to achieve that goal, you come up with all this other stuff. I'm going to call it stuff, which is not very journalistic or precise or academic. And that stuff doesn't work that well. It's not very effective in achieving that goal. It may achieve some other goals. So over time, you sort of fail to achieve the goal. And everyone's like, what happened to the percentage of Black students? And they're like, and you say, well, we have this and this and this, and we're doing this and this and this. And I think when you look at the state of like play on campus, why everyone feels like they're walking on eggshells, why they feel like they can't talk honestly in class. I think one reason, it's not just the DEI program. You can't blame it all on the DEI program, which is what the right would do, I think. But I think part of it is they have come up with all these other interventions in classrooms and on campus along the way to trying to achieve these larger goals that they really struggle to achieve. It's why you get speech regulation that goes too far, because they can't actually improve the climate or the enrollment in a way they want to of minority students. So they say, well, the problem is people are saying too many things that upset those students. Let's crack down. And you get an overcorrection.
I think one of the things the article does is it points out that there does not seem to be, at least as I read it, there doesn't seem to be a single way that this bureaucratic push for DEI has made students feel better or improved education or done anything except create a generation of tattling and petty investigations about slights that usually aren't even slights and made professors afraid and cynical about how to teach. Is there anything that in your reporting you came away and thinking like, oh yeah, this bureaucratic monstrosity that is DEI at the University of Michigan has in fact improved things in this one way?
Well, look, the campus is slightly more racially diverse at the student level. I think each of those percentage points is very hard won, but the slowness of the growth sort of tells the story. It's an overwhelmingly white campus still. They have more first-generation students. Again, the gains are incremental when you consider the percentage of the total enrollment. They have a more diverse faculty, but here too, you see some of the kind of cynicism and double talk that I think has started to pervade DEI work, which sounds like a weird thing because it's not a cynical program and the people who do it are not cynical, but they have a program called Collegiate Fellows. And this was a program designed to bring in junior faculty, so postdoctoral fellows of all specialties and put them on a tenure track to becoming professors at Michigan. And they aren't allowed to hire based on race or gender or identity. But they clearly want to improve race and gender diversity on the faculty. So what do? They came up with a proxy. And the proxy is, how committed are you in your research or your community work or your life experience to DEI? Right? And of course, as you know, we've seen this around the country, these kinds of programs where they do equity-based hiring, where they have cluster hiring. And you are meant to have a specialty of one kind or another in DEI. And when I talked to the top official who's in charge of DEI at the school, she said, look, this is not about hiring for diversity. We wouldn't want to do that. We're not going to hire someone based on their identity. It's about the skills they bring. And then I went and dug up with a FOIA, an application the school had done for federal funding for a related program. And it actually described this Collegiate Fellows program looking back at it, at what it accomplished. And I was kind of stunned at what I read. It said, we're not hiring people based on their identity. We're hiring them based on their commitment to DEI. But in the end, it's going to create racial diversity. And it was just obvious flimflam, right? That they had come up with something pretextual that the lawyers said, this will fly. And it stated outright that the goal of the program was to achieve racial diversity. That's not what they say the goal of the program is. Immaterials about the program.
I want to bring in the national context, Nick, of the backlash against DEI in states like Texas and Florida, where Republican governors have made it a thing that they are going to attack and have gone really far, you know, in addition by doing things like introducing laws that teachers can't teach, quote, divisive concepts or banning books. I just want to like pull out the various threads of this, right? Because you're talking about this massive bureaucracy at a very liberal institution, but there is also this push to, I think, use some of the excesses of DEI as an excuse to then, attack teaching American history and culture in a way that is like full and true. And so I just wonder how you kind of situate your own reporting in that larger context.
I mean, it's a great question. Before this story, I did an investigation of the Claremont Institute and their role in the anti-DEI movement. I wrote about Ron DeSantis and his education policies. And I would kind of put it broadly this way. There's a movement on a big part of the right to pass laws that say you can't teach certain things. And there is a movement in liberal states and liberal contexts to say you have to teach certain things. And I think anytime state power is being used in these contexts, there's something chilling about it. And I think that's worth keeping in mind in terms of the balance of forces. But again, you know, in California, you have, you know, various programs that are coming down from the top of the UC system around kind of equitable teaching and certain topics, both in high school and in universities. There is a massive struggle over what and how to teach. And I think I've seen conservative programs, certainly from Claremont and elsewhere, that are just mirror images of the kind of left-wing teaching stuff that they say they abhor. Their problem is not that the classroom is too politicized. Their problem is that the classroom is politicized in the wrong direction, right? So a Governor DeSantis or a Chris Rufo is not saying, let's get politics out of the classroom. They're saying, let's use state power where we can to make sure that if we're going to make people learn certain things, it's the right things. And in between, in my experience, in between these camps are a group of mostly conventionally liberal professors who are just saying, can we claw back some of the power over our own classrooms from both the state legislatures and from the administrative power center that has arisen at our universities over the last 30 or 40 years?
Nick Confessori's piece in the Times is about the University of Michigan's DEI efforts. Nick, thanks so much for coming on the Gabfest.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Let's go to cocktail chatter. I continue to really enjoy my bar cart, and I continue to wish that I could serve a cocktail to John Dickerson, but I'm going to serve a virtual cocktail to John, and you're going to give me your virtual cocktail chatter. John, what are you going to be chattering about this week at your parties?
Two tiny little chatters. One is that a new rule went into effect on Wednesday, I think it was, which allows no smoking signs on planes to stay on permanently, which you might think, well, that's weird. It's been 30 years since you weren't allowed to smoke on planes for the last 30 years, but they finally got around. There was apparently this vestigial rule that stayed on the books that suggested that the no smoking lights could be turned off. And I did always wonder about this, like what would ever be the case? Turns out it was. So now the lights can stay on all the time. The rules are in keeping with the behaviors. But what I didn't realize is that basically the whole that it wasn't just that airlines were accommodating smoking on planes. It's that the cigarette makers rushed into the space and basically made smoking on the planes a thing, which if you ever flew during the age of when you can smoke on planes and sat in the smoking section, It is the most unpleasant experience. Even if you're a smoker, as I was when those planes were around, it was torture. And yet cigarette makers, just sometimes when you're not in the culture of cigarette smoking the way we once were, you forget. But they basically handed out cigarettes on planes. And ultimately, flight attendants had to, I believe it was through a class action lawsuit, to beat back this effort to turn planes into smoke, you know, flying ashtrays. So that little bit of history exists. And and in New Zealand, one airport has implemented a maximum time of just 3 minutes to say goodbye to your loved ones. Because it's clogging up the airports when people say goodbye. They take too long to say goodbye. So if you're in New Zealand, get your shit together before you say goodbye to your loved one, because you only have 3 minutes. It seems like 3 minutes is a long time to say goodbye.
You've been chattering for 3 minutes.
And you would now like to say goodbye to me.
Emily, what is your chatter?
My chatter is two things I so enjoyed reading this week. One is a story in The New Yorker by Joshua Cohen called My Camp. It's fiction. It's one of the most incisive, funny, mordant things I've read about Israel-Palestine and American Jews. And somehow the fact that it was fiction just allowed for all of this, like, just insight but biting commentary from all sides. I really thought it was great. And the second thing is a nonfiction piece in The Atlantic by Clint Smith called How Do You Forgive the People Who Killed Your Family? And it's about what remembering the Rwandan genocide looks inside Rwanda 30 years later, and these like really profound questions about how the society has tried to move on from their absolutely horrific massacres there in the 1990s. So, Clint Smith in The Atlantic, Joshua Cohen in The New Yorker, totally worth one's time.
I want to chatter about something that I read that was wonderful in the Washington Post, which has been the source of like all of my chatters the last month or so.
I know, you're very much going off your New York Times, New Yorker thing.
I know. Well,
that's good.
It's a great paper. Good. Uncomfortably, it's an advertiser on a GabFest. And so they advertise, but that's just totally separate. It's a great paper. Anyway, my old dear friend Juliet Eilperin and Carolyn Van Houten and Alice Lee went to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska, and just did an amazing article, but also video, but also audio about what that place is like. And it's, if you've heard about it, you've heard people talk about drilling, how we have to drill there, we can't drill there. And very, very, very few people ever get up there because it's incredibly remote. And these reporters just did a stupendous job making the place come to life. The portrait of the porcupine herd, the 218,000 caribou, the herd of caribou that thunders across the tundra. And there's this incredible audio of just the sound of their hooves on the tundra. They're birds migrating, polar bears, lemmings, but also the incredibly rich disagreement between everybody. The people who live in the refuge want there to be drilling for the most part. Other people don't want there to be drilling. There's disagreement depending on which native population, which native tribe you're talking to, which people who study the nature there you're talking to. And it's a very nuanced and fascinating piece with beautiful images and great reporting. So check it out. Listeners, please email your chatter to us. Please email us at gabfest@slate.com. Something you're chattering about at your cocktail party. Something that has caught your mind, distracted you from things you don't want to think about. And keep them coming. This week's listener chatter comes from Aaron in Portland.
Hey, GabFest. This is Aaron Brindell. Scientists are growing stem cells into small human brain cell organoids, then connecting them together and using them for biocomputing. And if you let these organoids grow too long, they actually start to grow eyes, which can sense light. They're wildly more energy efficient than traditional computers. In a world where Microsoft is just paid to restart a decommissioned nuclear power plant to power their AI aspirations, if these were truly found to be viable for the future of CPU, GPU use, imagine the economic pressures to use them for winning the AI wars. You can imagine 50 years from now, a server farm of tiny preformed human brains all chained together to form one giant human brain processor running an artificial intelligence. To get a little silly about it, Elon loves to think we're in a simulation. What if it's not that we are the Matrix, but we're actually just a bunch of Internet of Things smart home appliances?
Also, listeners, if you have a conundrum, please send it to us at slate.com/conundrum and come to our live show at the Bell House on December 4th. You can get tickets at slate.com/gabfestlive. That is all for this episode this week, but we have a bonus episode in your feed. We're going to talk about all the things that Elon Musk is doing to get Trump elected and whether they are legal and whether they're helping. That is just for Slate Plus members, who also get lots of other great stuff for their subscription, bonus episodes at other shows, discounts to live shows, including our live show coming up in New York, and discount tickets to hang out with us at the cocktail party. You don't hit the paywall on the Slate site if you're a Slate Plus member. So if you are a member, again, thank you. Enjoy it. If you're not a member, you can subscribe to Slate Plus directly from the Political Gabfest show page on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify, or visit slate.com/gabfestplus to get access wherever you listen. That's our show for today. The Gabfest is produced by Shana Roth. Our researcher is Julie Hugen. Our theme music is by They Might Be Giants, Ben Richmond, Senior Director for Podcast Operations, Alicia Montgomery, VP of Audio for Slate. For J.D. Vance, I was saying J.D. Vance because I was thinking about VPs. For Emily Bazelon, not J.D. Vance, and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.